John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, May the 16th, 2011. On Saturday, Palestinian medical sources in Jerusalem reported that Milad Sayed Ayash, 17, died of wounds suffered on Friday during clashes with the Israeli police in Silwan in occupied East Jerusalem. Eyewitnesses reported that the bullet was fired by a settler from one of the floors of the illegal Yonatan outpost in Batan al-Hawa neighbourhood. The settler fired the rounds at the protesting youths in the area, witnesses told the Bokra website. Dum-dum bullets are rounds of live ammunition designed to expand on impact in order to cause a larger diameter wound. Israel Police Superintendent Luba Samri stated on Saturday that the police detained 20 Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem following clashes with the army and the police in several areas of the city. Several Palestinians and a number of police officers were injured. Samri stated that 8 policemen were injured during the clashes, including 5 who required hospitalisation for further treatment. She added that the police decided to impose restrictions on entry to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem as males below the age of 40 would not be allowed in. Palestinians from the West Bank holding entry permits to Jerusalem will not be allowed into the mosque. Israeli authorities decided to implement a 24-hour closure of the West Bank under direct orders issued by the Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak. The Israeli radio reported that Israel will be deploying nearly 10,000 policemen and soldiers to East Jerusalem and in Arab towns in the 1948 territories. The Israeli government said that it will be arresting any person who attempts to mark the Nakba in Israel and also deployed hundreds of policemen in cities that have Arab and Jewish inhabitants. Despite Israeli laws which effectively criminalise commemoration of Nakba Day that marks the creation of Israel on Palestinian lands and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, thousands of residents, including Jewish peace activists, marched on Saturday evening in Jaffa and held an art festival affirming the Palestinian historic rights and their legitimate struggle against oppression and occupation. Several intellectuals and local leaders delivered speeches in which they stated that Israel needs to realise that the Palestinians are not immigrants, but are natives of the country despite Israeli occupation and aggressive, and the forced removal of refugees. An estimated 4 people were killed on Sunday on the Syrian-Israel border. 5 were killed on the Lebanon-Israel border, 52 were injured in Gaza, and at least 24 injured in the West Bank as Israeli forces attacked Palestinian refugees trying to re-enter their former homes in what is now Israel. Thousands of Palestinian refugees in southern Lebanon did try to cross the border with Israel on Sunday morning and were met with gunfire from Israeli troops stationed there. Local sources report that at least 5 people were killed and 10 wounded by Israeli gunfire in the Marun Arras area. In Gaza, according to local sources, around 1,000 Palestinian refugees and supporters in the Gaza Strip marched on the Eretz border crossing between Israel and Gaza. Palestinian medical sources in the Strip reported that a Palestinian youth was killed and at least 172 were wounded on Sunday due to the Israeli military's excessive use of force against return protests in different parts of the coastal region. The sources stated that Israeli troops based near the Nahal Oz crossing the east of Gaza City killed an 18-year-old youth identified as Salah Khamis from Jabalia in the northern part of the Strip. Palestinian refugees from the West Bank also marched to the Qalandia checkpoint, which was established by Israeli forces as a main border crossing between the West Bank and what is now Israel. Although Qalandia's location is far east of the international agreed armistice line of 1967 and indicates a possible land grab by Israel if it is established as an actual border. At least 5 Palestinian youths were injured when Israeli forces fired live rounds at a group of youths throwing stones during the largely peaceful demonstrations of several thousand people at Qalandia. Dozens more were injured by rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas inhalation. In Al-Walaja village, a site known for non-violent anti-wall protests, several hundred Palestinians, internationals and Israelis marched to the site of the wall construction in the centre of the village. A total of 11 peace activists and reporters were detained on Sunday by the Israeli military as they attempted to march to the old village. Those detained include leading activist Dr. Mazim Qumseya, chairman of the board of the Palestinian Centre for Rapprochement Between People, parent organisation of the IMEMC. The 7 arrested international activists have subsequently been released, 4 Palestinians remain in custody in Atarot prison in Jerusalem. At least 63 Palestinians have been detained by Israeli forces at protests in the West Bank and Jerusalem since Friday. Palestinian medical sources reported on Sunday that at least 150 Palestinians were injured by Israeli military fire, while dozens of residents were kidnapped as the army opened fire at return protests in Ramallah and El Bira on Sunday. A source at the Ramallah government hospital said that 150 residents were admitted to the hospital, including 7 who were in serious condition. Rubber-coated metal bullets hit dozens of the wounded, while dozens of residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In response, Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu has denounced the protests, stating that they were not about the 1967 borders or the right of return of refugees, but questioned the very existence of Israel. Netanyahu defended the actions of the Israeli military, saying that Israel was determined to defend its sovereignty. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has also defended the actions of the military, placing blame for the deaths with those who crossed the border and those who sent them. He warned that such instances were just the beginning of similar problems in the future. Israel has confirmed that it will renew the transfer of tax payments collected on Palestinians' behalf to the Palestinian Authority. Finance Minister Yavul Steinitz confirmed rumours started by the Union of Civil Servants that the payment due to Palestinian government workers for April, due to them since the 5th of the month, would be paid by the end of the day on assurances from the PA. In a statement, Steinitz claimed that he had received assurances from the PA that no funds would be transferred to Hamas or to any other terrorist groups. That's all for today from the IMEMC. This was Monday, the 16th of May's daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope that you will join us again tomorrow. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Qasis and me, David Steele.
On May 4th, Fatah, the Palestinian faction that rules the West Bank, and Hamas, the Islamist faction that controls Gaza, signed a pact in Cairo that would unite the two rival parties to form a transitional government and hold long-delayed elections in both territories within a year. Because Hamas has refused to renounce violence or recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, Israel condemned the move, while the Obama administration is taking a wait-and-see approach. The Palestinian Accord puts at risk hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. aid for Fatah's Washington-supported Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, since the U.S. considers Hamas a terrorist organization and could refuse to fund any government that they're a part of. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chris Tenzing, longtime editor of Middle East Report, about the Palestinian Accord. He says the reconciliation was a response to the grassroots Palestinian demand to end the debilitating division that presented a major obstacle for the resumption of meaningful negotiations with Israel. The pact also sets the stage for an effort to pursue international recognition of a Palestinian state at the United Nations this September. Tenzing addresses how the U.S. and Israel are likely to respond to Hamas and what Hamas and Fatah both hope to gain from this new arrangement.
I would say Israel and the U.S. are setting up hurdles for Hamas that Hamas cannot jump over, and I think Israel and the U.S. know that. Specifically, the hurdles are the so-called quartet conditions that were put in place, I believe, in 2006 as conditions for Hamas to join the U.S.-sponsored peace process alongside other Palestinian parties. And those conditions would be acceptance of previous agreements that Palestinians have made with Israel, the Oslo Accords and so on, renouncing all forms of violence, and accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And Hamas is not going to give a firm answer one way or another to either of those conditions. On the question of violence, Hamas will say that they offer a long-term ceasefire, which, of course, they have done in the past and have observed in the past, largely without incident, not completely, but largely. And that's for the reason that Hamas does not want to appear to Palestinians as being sort of unilaterally disarming in the conflict. And since Hamas has won a large part of its current political support from Palestinians, even those who are not Islamist, on the strength of resisting what Palestinians see as Israeli aggression against them, then Hamas could not sort of appear to be laying down its arms without some kind of promise of the same from Israel. And then with regard to the second question of accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, that relates to the right of return for Palestinian refugees, also the future status of Palestinian citizens of Israel, who Hamas or Fatah, for that matter, as leaders of the Palestinian people as a whole, consider themselves in some representative relationship to. So the idea there is that they don't want to appear to be sort of saying that any agreement with Israel is now and forever to forestall any unification of the Palestinian people and the diaspora in the lands from which those people were expelled in 1948. It's very unlikely that Hamas will, you know, agree to those things. And so since they're not going to agree to those things, that largely drowns out the news, which is that, you know, Khaled Mashal, the spokesman of Hamas based in Damascus, has stated very clearly this time, with no sort of ambiguity whatsoever, that Hamas will recognize the pre-1967 borders as the provisional borders of an Israel and a Palestine, with Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, and with settlements in the West Bank removed and no land swaps. I mean, it was a very clear statement that Mashal made. So basically, Hamas is going a considerable distance further, in fact, than they have gone to date. And the response so far of Israel has been to reject the agreement, and the response of the United States has been wait and see, but keep the existing blockades and so on in place.
It's a pretty big financial gamble for Abbas to risk millions in U.S. support. Even if the Obama administration is taking a wait and see attitude, I can imagine members of Congress moving to cut funding, you know, pretty much immediately. Do you agree?
I'm sure that that they do regard it as something of a gamble, but I think they probably think that it's a gamble they had no choice but to make. The alternative to make no attempt on the Palestinian side to set the agenda or seize the initiative would be to leave the status quo to fester. And the status quo is untenable for the Palestinians. The best that the Palestinians could hope for under Netanyahu or under a successor government led by the Kadima Party, the, you know, what is now called the centrist party in Israel, which is leading in most of the polls that are taken, the best that the Palestinians could hope for would be a unilateral Israeli declaration of a Palestinian state based on provisional borders, which would have no guarantees about any of these so-called final status issues, in which Israel would retain all sorts of rights and all sorts of impingements upon Palestinian sovereignty. And that just would essentially be basically a legalization of the status quo. So if the Palestinians are going to have any measure of real sovereignty, they have a considerable obligation here to try to set the agenda on something closer to their own terms. And that's what I think they have done. And we can't leave out the popular pressure either, which is a very important factor. And in the broader environment of the Arab world, in the wake of the Tunisian Revolution and the Egyptian Revolution and the outbreak of popular uprisings across the Arab world, including Syria and other countries, and mass protests in Jordan, countries very close to Palestine with large Palestinian refugee populations, there was a great deal of pressure on the Palestinian leadership to put aside their own differences, which were considerable, and try to work together toward a common national goal.
That was Chris Tenzing of Middle East Report. Find a link to the latest reports on the Israel-Palestine conflict at our website at btlonline.org.
Helmand Province, Afghanistan, Sunday. The British Marine was killed by an IED. Afghanistan, Friday the 13th. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Friday the 13th. An Afghan policeman opened fire on NATO trainers during lunch, killing two of them. He was seriously wounded by return fire. Afghanistan, Saturday. There is a report that insurgents opened fire on a medical evacuation helicopter marked with the Red Cross as it attempted to recover a wounded soldier of unknown nationality. The soldier had been wounded by an IED. Western Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan, Saturday. Another night raid killed an innocent 15-year-old boy who was asleep in a field. This was the second killing of a child or teenager in 3 days by occupation forces in Nangarhar. Sparked a 200-person march in Nara, the boy's hometown. As protesters advanced on the center of town, police opened fire, killing a 14-year-old boy. Pakistan, Friday the 13th. Multiple suicide bombers killed 80 police recruits boarding buses outside a training center near Peshawar, close to the Afghan border. The Taliban claims the strike is vengeance for the killing of bin Laden, but some in Pakistan suspect another motive. In nearby Momand, the Pakistani army has begun an occupation sweep against insurgents, and some say the bombers might have been from there. Pakistan, Friday the 13th. At least 5 oil tank trucks bound for NATO forces in Afghanistan were burned and one blown up by a bomb planted beneath one of them. There were 21 trucks in the terminal. The rest of them were moved out of the way, and no one was harmed by the blast or subsequent fire. Diwania, Iraq, Saturday. 2 Katyusha rockets fell on the outskirts of the U.S. Camp Echo, west of southern Iraq's Diwania city, early on Friday night. As usual, losses were, quote, not known, according to the security source informing Oswald al-Iraq News Agency on Saturday. Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. 5 Katyusha rockets and 4 mortar rounds were fired into the Green Zone, housing offices of the puppet government, plus the U.S. and British embassies. 2 of the mortar rounds missed the Green Zone, landing in Baghdad's Tahrir or Liberation Square, killing 2 pedestrians and wounding 10 more. Reuters reported this incident as 9 rockets fired into the Green Zone, killing 1 and wounding 9, possibly inside the Green Zone, as their report is unclear. Yet another report, again calling all the projectiles rockets, reported 4 that missed the fortified Green Zone. Amara, Iraq, Saturday. A roadside bomb hit a U.S. Army patrol in southern Iraq's Amara city without causing human or material losses, the chairman of the Security and Defense Committee of Mesan Province's council reported Saturday. Kut, Iraq, Sunday. Another roadside bomb hit another U.S. Army patrol, shaking the city of Kut. The main street fruit and vegetable shops and civilian cars were damaged, as well as one of the cars in the U.S. convoy.
Wait a minute. What roadside bomb? What U.S. Army patrol? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, you got what you came for in Afghanistan. Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. And 8 years of war haven't changed a thing. Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
Months before an elite U.S. military team killed Osama bin Laden in his hideout in Pakistan, there was a strong movement toward crafting a new peace formula in Afghanistan, including the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the United States. In the short run, the Taliban may have launched a new offensive against NATO forces, but sources say pressure will mount for a political settlement through a unity government as the U.S. war in Afghanistan approaches its 10th anniversary. The raid against bin Laden has placed added pressure on the Taliban to cut all ties with al-Qaeda, whose forces have little military presence inside Afghanistan. According to the Christian Science Monitor, movement toward a peace agreement includes Turkey, which is now allowing the Taliban to open an office in the pro-Western Muslim country, while Afghanistan and Pakistan initiated a joint peace commission. The covert American raid that killed bin Laden inside Pakistan has also put hardliners that block past peace efforts within the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, on the defensive.
Suppose army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
It wasn't long after President Obama's May 1st announcement that a U.S. Navy SEAL commando team had killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan that former members of the Bush administration and their allies celebrated the role they claimed U.S. torture of terrorist suspects had played in locating the al-Qaeda leader. Former Vice President Dick Cheney said that waterboarding, which was banned by President Obama in January 2009, was, quote, a good program. It was a legal program. It was not torture. I would strongly recommend we continue it. While the former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld stated, quote, it was a mistake to rule out waterboarding. It's clear that those techniques that the CIA used worked. The motivation of former members of the Bush administration for defending torture is transparent, as their actions are considered war crimes under international law and as individuals could be subject to prosecution when they travel abroad. But apart from the legal issues, most interrogation experts agree that the only effective method of extracting reliable information from detainees is to use non-coercive methods and to build trust with suspects. General David Petraeus, who commands U.S. forces in Afghanistan and has been selected by President Obama to head the CIA, has asserted many times that U.S. torture serves as a major terrorist recruiting tool. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First, who explains why he rejects claims that torture is an effective interrogation method and believes that the abuse of terrorist suspects hindered efforts in locating Osama bin Laden.
The moment that the news, you know, flashed about the bin Laden operation, people from within the former Bush administration got to work to try to credit this to the policies of George Bush, and particularly the detention and interrogation policies of Bush. And there were a good number of reasons why they would want to do that. Of course, everybody wants their work to be shown in the best light. But when their work amounts to war crimes, and when they have to be concerned about the possibility of being prosecuted for war crimes, then they have an extra incentive to put a different face on their policies. And I think it's quite knee-jerk, and obviously knee-jerk, that the purveyors of torture policy in the Bush administration are the same people who came out and said that Osama bin Laden's death is attributable to these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, torture. And the reason I think it's way too generous to call this thing even a debate is that what they're doing is simply making the allegation. And unfortunately, in today's kind of media slugfest, making an allegation seems to be the equivalent of making it stick. But if you listen to the details, and the details are already known, then you would come up with a very different conclusion than torture works. What we hear from Cheney and John Yoo and others in the Bush administration who were big fans of these policies is that Guantanamo detainees were subjected to waterboarding, which is also somewhat of a euphemism for suffocation. And when they were subjected to waterboarding, they later gave information leading to a courier that led the United States to Osama bin Laden. And if that's all you know, you would conclude that there was a cause and effect relationship between torture and getting this information. The reality is that people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the Guantanamo detainees, and another Guantanamo detainee were waterboarded many, many, many times over. In the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, 183 instances in the course of 1 month, and he divulged nothing about couriers leading to Osama bin Laden. Then, many months, something like a year after the brutal interrogations stopped and lawful interrogations took their place, that's when KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, gave the information that led to the courier. So, rather than saying that torture leads to information that leads to Osama bin Laden, which is how some would have it, it seems to me much more logical to conclude that torture actually impeded the ability of the United States to gain intelligence that would have led much, much earlier to bin Laden. And, you know, how many instances of terrorism could have been prevented if the United States had started and ended with lawful interrogation techniques instead of torture is the real speculation here.
Gabor Rona, maybe you could tell us a bit about the motivation of some of these former Bush administration officials who were involved in administering or ordering these torture techniques and what they've got at stake in terms of possible future prosecution here in the United States or internationally, so that they certainly have a stake in defending their policies that they were involved in vis-a-vis torture.
It does look like, at the very least, many of these Bush officials that were responsible for promulgating and implementing torture policies are not going to be traveling to, you know, Western European countries anytime soon for fear of being indicted and arrested there. However, the best information we get is that the U.S. government has made efforts to try to get some of those countries like Germany and Spain to back off these former Bush officials because it would be embarrassing for the United States, bad for Obama, for whatever reason. In the United States, you know, any time the Obama administration does something in connection with torture policy, some of these folks, like Cheney, like you, like Addington, Bybee, are not only ready and willing, but available and are called upon by the media in the U.S. to give their points and counterpoints, when instead they should actually be being prosecuted in federal courts for what they've done. And what they've done is nothing more or less than order and implement policies of torture, and in situations of armed conflict, that's a war crime, plain and simple, under international law and under U.S. law.
That was Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First. Find more information on Human Rights Group's views on torture on our website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Dominic Strauss-Kuhn, head of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, has been arrested and held without bond. He is charged with sexual assault and attempted rape after pursuing a hotel maid to the ritzy $3,000 a night hotel he was staying in New York and attempting to force her to have sex with him. He is being held as a literal flight risk, having been captured boarding an aircraft attempting to leave the U.S. He has been known at the IMF as a strong supporter of IMF bailouts and IMF-imposed austerity for Greece, Portugal, and Ireland, three nations with weak economies that bankers have been chasing through the corridors of power. Massive riots and street battles in Greece have resulted from these policies. The annual spring and fall meetings of the IMF and World Bank have brought protesters to D.C. for over a decade. Long have IMF protesters and IMF rioters in many nations said exploited nations should cut off so-called debt repayment to the IMF and World Bank. This is because the IMF and World Bank have always tried to plunder anything they or their corporate overlords want without restraint. Are women working in hotels just another natural resource that the IMF and its bosses can exploit and plunder? I have just one thing to say to the IMF. They can stick their supposed impunity and their so-called debts where the sun doesn't shine.
Congress, you've lots to do. Don't run our city too. We're citizens just like you and demand what's right. What gives you justly cause to rewrite our own laws? Who made you king? You preach democracy. Beware hypocrisy. In the free world's capital, let home rule.
On the 11th of May,
protesters demanding statehood for D.C. and an end to GOP interference in D.C.'s budget marched out of Upper Senate Park and blocked Constitution Avenue, leading to what looked like 9 people being arrested.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, those D.C. riots have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, those D.C. riots have got to go.
That being, of course, the budget riders, the social policy riders against the District of Columbia that the GOP has attached to the budget bill for the 2011 fiscal year and presumably will continue to attempt to attach to the 2012 budget. Before protesters swarmed out on Constitution Avenue and blocked all traffic, here's what some people had to say in Upper Senate Park.
And they think that, you know, we're going to do this and we'll slip in a rider and we'll go after the District of Columbia and we'll take away the Congresswoman's vote in Committee of the Whole, and there won't be a consequence. And so what people have said is I want there to be a consequence, and I want to be able to, through my own person, express that consequence.
This movement is not going to stop. It's not going to stop when we get a vote in the House. It's not going to stop when we get budget autonomy or legislative autonomy. This movement will only stop when there's another star on the American flag that represents the people of the District of Columbia.
You heard that? People in D.C. are sick and tired of playing defense against GOP social budget riders and are going on the offense and won't stop for anything short of full statehood. Hey, Republicans, why don't you put that in your tea bag and drink it?
On the 9th of May, former D.C. school chancellor Michelle Rhee made the mistake of showing up at the Marriott on 22nd Street along with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker
and Pennsylvania Governor Scott Corbett,
who was going so far as to promise to cut the school budget while spending tax money on vouchers for private and religious schools. The event was funded by the so-called American Federation for Children, whose name is a direct jab at the American Federation of Teachers, with funding from people like the Koch brothers, who've been funding so many far right-wing and Tea Party causes, funding from Betsy and Dick DeVos, who are related to Eric Prince of Blackwater. And in fact, one sign there said that vouchers are to education as Blackwater is to the military. Not surprisingly, having this many Republican union-busting thugs at the Marriott drew enough protesters to entirely fill the sidewalk in front.
In my state of Pennsylvania, our governor has proposed to cut $1.2 billion in education. He says we can't afford it. He still stands up and argues for the virtues of tuition vouchers. He still proposes to spend money we don't have to fund them.
The billionaires who are pushing vouchers on public schools say it's about choice, but here's what someone from Milwaukee had to say about the effect of vouchers on choice in the schools.
And before vouchers entered the Milwaukee public school system, parents had a choice. We have language immersion schools. We have art specialty schools. We have IB schools, and we have advanced placement schools. When vouchers came in, they did damage to all those choices parents already had. And now our students are left with art schools that only say art on the front of the building.
That's right.
There are no art supplies, and in many of them, there are no art teachers.
Get on the sidewalk, please!
And I am a parent also of 2 public school students. And I am worried that if Walker and Corbett and DeVos and all these people continue on seeing this as a business instead of a human right, we are going to be out here growing in numbers because we are not going to give up.
That's right.
Head rock, DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is a movement, music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming, coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about chocolate city unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City.
Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Overseer plantation mentality results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
12th of May, representatives of Walmart and a would-be developer for the Ward 4 site, Folger Pratt, were on hand at a public meeting of ANC 4B, specifically on the subject of Walmart on Georgia Avenue. Walmart is already under siege. As DDOT has said, it failed to answer 7 out of 10 questions concerning traffic in the large track review that they had submitted. At the ANC meeting, like in the large track review, Walmart representatives ducked and refused to answer questions.
Of this Walmart site. Will Walmart remain open or will Walmart close if the union succeeds in organizing Walmart's workers?
The answer to that is the same as it was last time, that any of the issues like that are governed by the National Labor Relations Board on this or any other retailer that has really no bearing on the application.
Except that they're not. There's nothing in the NLRB that says that because a store has become unionized, it therefore cannot legally be closed. And in fact, every time a Walmart has been unionized, the store was closed. At one time, the meatpacking department was unionized in one Walmart in Texas. They closed the in-house meat cutting in every Walmart in the world. The question was not answered.
I heard his question.
but the answer does not relate to the question. The question was, if I understood it correctly, would Walmart close a union organizer to avoid having a union? And the answer he gave did not answer that question. It's either a yes or a no.
Okay. Well, we have no plans to close any store. You can go on a web search.
No, no, no. Just say yes or no.
Yes or no. Walmart closed the store. We've not closed the store.
Kind of yes or no.
Actually, the left.
Again, we have no plans to close any store. That was the question.
Of course, they have no plans to have a union at the Walmart on Georgia Avenue either. If that changes, their other plans could also change. They didn't answer that question. Here's another example of someone that had a question for Walmart. Walmart wouldn't even take the stand to reply.
Select yourself. We're told that Walmart, and you'll have to excuse me, I don't have my glasses, will create jobs, jobs, and more jobs. Excuse me, that is a selling point for us. However, I'm trying to paraphrase. Walmart will create 300 jobs per store. But a study of Walmart history reveals that for every job Walmart creates, the community loses 1.4 jobs as a result. When you use this data, and I'm not a statistical person, for all the four Walmarts that I want to construct in Washington, add 300 employees per store, the city will gain 1,200 jobs, but will lose 1,680 jobs at a net loss of 480 jobs for the city. And that's a loss of 480 jobs for the city. And also there is a study, the Chicago study, reveals that after construction of a Walmart in a Chicago neighborhood with 306 stores, the community saw 82 stores go out of business within 9 months from 3208 to 11208. Now that's just the first paragraph. And this is constructed from positive, actual research. I would ask you, please, to go over and pick up this newsletter and look at it and study it. And many of you can research. And I would like then to ask the question, how do you, this is factual, how do you say to us that we are going to gain from Walmart being there? I would like to hear.
Deafening silence in the room as nobody from Walmart would answer the question of how Walmart can be good for the community if 1.4 people lose their jobs for every job Walmart creates in their stores because all the other stores go out of business. Town after town in rural America has been turned into rows and rows of boarded up and vacant storefronts by Walmart. Do we want Georgia Avenue to be next? Does anybody want to see so many boarded up buildings on Georgia Avenue that it'll look like South Bronx, New York City 20 years ago? I don't think so. Walmart, you need to respect DC by staying the hell away. Remember that attempt to close the West End Library in 2007? The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks? Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The City Council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, Vice President of Acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yes, sir. If indeed East Bank is does not want to be secretive, if indeed East Bank does not want to be secretive, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site. And
now, with Fenty and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?